Hello and welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
Now, we're going to just dive right into our series of interviews today. So as I promised last week, I was able to do interviews with a couple of different Americans. We've got Nate Garner of Lesbi Gay, the podcast. Also, we've got the four aunties of the Minority Report. And we were also able to get self-professed GOP member Christopher Daniels also to join us. So right now, let's dive right into the interview I did with Nate Garner. And just after that, we have Night Moon by Jordan Paul. And then Now I'm 64, the cover by Alison Krauss. Hello and welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. I am very excited to have one of my many guests lined up for today's show. We are speaking with Garner, who's currently in St. Louis, but is from Minooka, Illinois. Now, you actually mentioned earlier, you were, you know, born and raised in a cornfield. Maybe not literally in the field, but...
No, and quite literally in a cornfield. I mean, I... grew up in a tiny, tiny cornfield, first one south of Chicago in Illinois. My parents were divorced, so I had two houses, and both of their backyards were full-fledged fields that I spent more time in than in an open air.
Excellent. And I'm kind of curious, what was the feeling of Minooka, Illinois? Are they Trump supporters? Are they Democrats, Republicans? How was growing up there like?
It was very interesting, and it wasn't something I was aware of, too, until I moved out and away and was looking at it more objectively. I would say that, like, the adults that were there were very conservative. The kids were almost more liberal, and that in, like, a minor sense, too, because, I mean, I still connect with some people back home, and they definitely are, like, for Trump. Their kids are dying and want to leave, you know? It's a very mixed bag, I'll say that.
I think for our Canadian audience, where there's a bit of a generational shift, do you think that's the same happening in Illinois?
Well, Illinois has always been blue in terms of like the state shifting, but I agree that young people, after these last 4 years, became very aware of what politics are, especially after, I want to say it was the 2016 election, where some people, even like when they turned 18, started like writing in joke names. Kind of because they didn't have a care in the world. And it was very common for young people to not get involved with politics. And it wasn't until, again, these last 4 years slapped it in front of our face. And we have the social media and these ways to connect with other communities in this giant freaking country that we live in. And it wasn't until young people started voting that things started turning blue.
Now, I'm not going to ask you to reveal who or what you voted for, but I'm kind of...
I just giggled. I was like, it's not obvious, is it?
The whole point of this show is really connecting with folks like yourself who have lived through, you know, the last 4 years. And do you consider yourself political? I mean, you don't...
Yes, I am political. And I'm one of those young people that became political over the last 4 years and sort of realized how important it is. And especially I, as an artist now, I'm majoring in musical theater. I, as an artist who has this platform, has to have an opinion. And especially with everything that's happened with even just the last year, sitting by and being apolitical feels like more of an injustice than not.
There's an interesting theory in sort of old queer politics that, you know, being gay is political. The body is politic. You know, you can't be queer in a space and that not be in itself a political act in terms of ruffling feathers, etc.
Yeah, my co-host says that all the time, M. Perkins. She's this fabulous lesbian woman, but she says all the time that inherently everything I do is queer because I am, and therefore everything I do is a statement. And we talk about that on the podcast with representation and us, regards to us being actors, like playing certain roles, and then also the work that we put out says something, and people react to it whether they think so or not.
So one of the things that, from the outside looking into the United States, Can Queer hasn't really addressed US and US politics too much. I think this sort of aversion to American politics really comes out of the fight for same-sex marriage in the United States. And it was just a roller coaster of emotions every week. We've only really talked about Trump in terms of how Trumpism has impacted the rest of the world. So I'm kind of curious as to how has that played out, you know, in your own backyard?
There are many little snippets of this complicated government system that America has, very few snippets that people know and understand for like their own gain and just throw out at specific times. And especially in terms of like free speech and right to do this. And it's always a matter of like, I'm allowed to do that because it's my business and the Constitution says that I can. And it's giving us the right to have an opinion and to freely speak that opinion is different than the right to discriminate against other people. It's sort of when people use slurs and people use these different sort of ways to put other people down, the issue isn't like that they're speaking physically, it's that their morality is physically in the wrong place, which isn't like even necessarily a government issue, but a morality issue. And the whole thing with the Trump presidency is that it's turned into Trumpism is a mindset and a force moving forward that honestly, if you know, like the full, you know, Constitution contradicts with many, many other rules that people don't fully understand. And again, it's like deeper in certain parts of the country. Because again, I in a city wouldn't face that as much as when I was in Manuka in this tiny town where I didn't get a job at a hardware store because I was told I float when I walk, you know, like little things.
I mean, I shouldn't laugh, but I mean,
no, that's hilarious. Yeah, I get it. Yeah. I know.
There are some things that are, you know, universal across North America. Like when I first moved to Canada, I moved into very small town, very rural. And there is definitely opinions and positions that you're going to face with any kind of community. Our show is broadcast into a lot of rural areas, and there are some truly incredible folks in those communities. I don't want to pull away from that. I mean, I can point to lots of little things like the Justice Department opposing cases of discrimination and the Education Department here and the State Department doing this. But really, I think what it boils down to is whether or not the state of the United States of America, the sort of federal government, are they in your corner? And how do you think that's going to differ under the Trump years versus the Biden years?
I think that it's terrible that I have to worry about this every 4 years. I think that the next 2 years, I feel pretty solid in, because it's not just the president who is the face. There's also all the other branches of Congress that also have to be controlled by a similar political party. And when ours has become so either red or blue, and they have such ideas, in 2 years, when we start seats are up in Congress and we vote new people in, it could switch to red. And then we don't have this total power anymore. So in terms of my comfort or like confidence going forward.
Because right now you've got Trump in your corner and what that brings. And then you have Biden in your corner and what that brings. And I'm just curious as to how it feels from one to the other.
There's a weight off my shoulder knowing that the power is about to be shifted, but it's still not full certain. I fully believe that a Biden-Harris America is going to aim for progression. But I also know that within the last 4 years, a lot of things have been uncovered of like the little loopholes in our democracy and how we can sneak around these things. And I'm worried that though the hearts are in the right place, things won't be set in stone enough, or things won't be able to solidify enough to actually stick. Like even gay marriage came back on the table. It's a constant need to be political. Circling back to that, I have to constantly stay involved in politics because that's how I keep my rights in this country.
In Canada, we have the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and that has been pretty universal in protecting LGBT folks. But, you know, they were hard-fought battles in Canada as well. It was only about 10 years ago that some of those were even won. One of the things I wanted to pick up on was the idea of things sort of floating by. You know, it's great that, for example, today, time of recording, we found out that Dr. Rachel Levine of Pennsylvania, the health secretary there, who sort of rose to fame for being very efficient, very good at her job, and also attacked for being a trans woman, has now been tapped to join assistant secretary for the Department of Health and Human Services. Pete Buttigieg also joining as transport secretary. So, I mean, these are really encouraging announcements. But we also heard that the Biden-Harris administration has put out that the equality bill, which the Democratic Congress passed, I think last year, if not the year before, won't be able to get pushed through until after the 100 days. So does it concern you that the equality bill has been put on the back burner?
Yes. And this is going to sound terrible. Yes, it does concern me, but that is quite literally the standard at this point. And so concerned but not worried is a weird way to put it. But in a world where the process taking forever is like the norm, I'm not worried about it at all. And I also, maybe I've just gotten jaded, but I have to meet the country where it's at and understand that that's unfortunately how it is. And if that's the fastest way it's going to get done, as much as I would love to snap my fingers, I have to be more realistic about the situation.
So my last question relates to the legacy of Trump's one term in office. He went from the Republican trifecta of Senate, House, and presidency to losing all three by the end of his term. I think that's important to note. That is certainly its own legacy. But really, one of his biggest successes, I think, in terms of how folks are measuring it, is the two appointments to the Supreme Court of the United States. And we're seeing that come up now because the Supreme Court is looking at cases where the states, as to whether or not the states can legally discriminate in a Supreme Court case. Now, this could have huge impacts in Republican-controlled state legislatures, which is a lot of them across the US and a lot of people living inside those. How do you feel about the legacy of Trump's time in office?
I think it makes perfect sense that he is going to have a legacy and that he's quite literally validated so many people in this country that still have very dated and hateful views and very power-hungry views and sort of brought them to the surface. And now we're in this age of where that's been validated and there's a whole group of those people. There's likewise a group against, and it's sort of Trumpism isn't going to go away just because he's out of office. There's been a lot of discord between many people and the rest of their family, many young people and their older relatives, and many small communities, especially in states where there's one city that has the majority of the population turns the state blue. The rest of the state is completely red, small town where certain things don't affect them. So they don't understand why certain policies get passed through. I'm worried about states that fly under the radar because they've always been red. Because they've been, you know, conservative for a while. I'm worried about it going so far that people start getting hurt. I can list young people I've talked to about forced conversion therapies and like hate crimes that happen to them, and not just by like other kids, but full-on communities. Trumpism has like excited that out of people. And now there's people from like my small town bonding with people from the South that did that and spreading it. And it's becoming so polarized that it's good. I'm worried it's gonna normalize more hate crimes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, I'm glad you raised that point because one of the most difficult things to do each week in preparing for our show is seeing the news stories, and there's almost at least one a week, of a trans woman in insert town or city here who was murdered in a hate crime in the US. It is truly incredible, the scale and scope, and very concerning. There is a perception in Canada that the US has now got to a point where it is incredibly sort of diametrically opposed. You know, you've got your Trumpism and you've got your sort of musical theater kids in St. Louis, you know, and never the two shall meet. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, do you think that there's a path forward, maybe back into the center, back towards a sort of common community? When you think about your friends who you still connect with in Minooka, can you see a path forward?
I do. I think it's a very slim path, but I do. Even in the sense of people that like share my political views, things have become so polarized that people don't even want to communicate with one another, let alone meet them where they are and even have a conversation. I mean, in most times when I am being more political or working on activist sort of things and having these conversations, I always try to rely on sole facts and like debate. Whereas a lot of people emotions get too involved and it's just polarizing people in the opposite direction. Because there have been kids that from my high school that I have tried to talk to, I tried to reason with and tried to bring like statistics and facts and things that weren't just opinions that could be refuted. And there's literally a point of people don't want to be told that they're wrong or that they're bad people. I have this silly theory that everyone thinks they're a good person and no one does things because they are aware that they're evil. Everyone in their own head thinks they're doing the right thing for the world or whatever their moral compass points to. And the whole country now is debating where our morals should lie. And now people in really liberal bubbles are talking to people in really conservative bubbles. And it's raising the stakes and raising this heat and leading to people storming the Capitol, you know?
The conversations you're having, which humanize you, which share your experience, which bridge the divide from everyone being these sort of individual heroes in their own stories and sort of connects, you know, empathetically. I think that actually pivots really nicely to your podcast, because I think your podcast very much does that. It's this idea of talking the talk almost, like, you know, showing who you are to an audience who may be interested. Can you quickly explain a bit about your podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to plug my podcast. Me and my co-host M Perkins, we created our podcast Lesbigay because when the pandemic hit, we really needed a creative outlet. And we started having these conversations because she grew up in Marinette, Wisconsin, and then later moved to Winona, Minnesota. And she also grew up gay in a small town. And each week we just cover like a very basic topic. But a lot of the feedback that we get from people that are listening is very grateful about sort of discussing this middle ground that people don't talk about. Thinking about the story is either like, oh, you come out and people love and accept you because that's the way it should be. Or like, you get sent to gay conversion therapy. There's this middle ground of awkward that for us was more genuine. And when we started sharing this story, we uncovered a lot of like little things, little conversations that no one was having, and it honestly pulled out a lot of the roots of problems for, like, at least from people that have contacted us, these roots of problems that they were dealing with that they now feel like better people because of. And then it made us want to do it more. So now we have this podcast where we talk about what we call awkward in America, growing up queer in this crazy country where the most dramatic stories get the headlines. We are there to share what is real for us and real for a lot of kids in middle America.
I want to thank you so much for joining us and giving this sort of perspective of the awkward in the middle America and having lived through Trump and now your sort of forward vision into the Biden years. We'll be back just after this.
Thank you so much.
Hello and welcome back to Can Queer. I am very excited to be joined by Christopher Daniels. Thank you so much for joining me. You are a self-professed member of the GOP. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And just in layman's terms for our Canadian audience, that's essentially a Republican Party member.
Right.
Now, this week we're looking at how life has sort of been different under Trump to Biden and that sort of transition. But just before we started recording, I had asked you, is there room in the Republican Party for gay folks as a gay man in the Republican Party, with at least the media perception and sort of the Canadian perception of Trump's Republicanism, the sort of Trumpism? Is that a big enough tent for everybody to be welcoming? What are your thoughts on that?
I do think it's a big enough tent for everyone to be welcoming. I do feel like the Republican Party has not done the best job in the past to welcome the LGBT community, and they've been a little, you know, resistant towards gay marriage and the whole issue with the trans community and stuff. So they, you know, they definitely have their problems, but I don't think people give them enough credit. I think they deserve a little bit more credit, because I think they've evolved a bit more since the past 15, 20 years. I feel like it's kind of become a non-issue for them. Like, sure, there's some parts of the Republican Party that are not fond of the LGBT community, or they're against it, or they, you know, they condemn it. And you know what? Okay, great. But you know, that's fine. People can do it. People can think whatever they want to think, you know. And I just think that there are a lot of people that are Republicans and that are conservatives who just don't really care, you know, including President Trump. Like, it's a non-issue for them, because they've evolved to the point where it's just like, okay, what else we got going on? We got bigger fish to fry than you being gay. Like, we really don't care anymore. You know, Americans that are Republicans, I think a lot of them care about their families. They care about having work. They care about, you know, their religion, or what, you know, whatever faith they practice, and the whole issue. And I think they're starting to get a little irritated by it, because I feel like the LGBT community is kind of like beating them over the head with it. It's like, you know, I just think they're making it a thing when it's just not really a thing anymore.
You know, I think I can understand where you're coming from with this. And for our Canadian listeners, I think there's definitely an equivalent. You know, we have fiscal conservatism, the sort of more the sort of East Coast conservatives, where they worry about the budget, they're worried about taxes, they're worried about better business access, loss of, you know, less red tape. And then we're getting a bit more of the social conservatism. They're really concerned about abortion laws. They're really concerned about, you know, reopening some of those old debates in Canada. You know, so there's definitely two colors of conservative. I wonder, when I think of fiscal conservatism and I think of what you're telling me, I don't disagree. I think the GOP certainly has evolved. And we see that when you look at leaders in the GOP in the United States who have that sort of flavor of conservative, they absolutely have moved in their positions. But I'm wondering whether or not there's a vocal component from the social conservatives. You know, it's the loudest voice that's heard the most, you know, is often the challenge. Is it maybe social conservatism, which is what's creating such a target for LGBT activism?
I do think so. But I think at the same time, a lot of the problems the GOP has with the LGBT community, it's not because they hate them. And, you know, it feel like there's an attack on conservatives. I think maybe it has to do with, they feel like a lot of the LGBT community maybe feels like the way they've been treated in the past, they're holding on to a lot of that. And I feel like there's some deep resentments and hatred towards, you know, conservatives and the Republican Party, because they're holding on to those feelings. And they feel like they, you know, the conservatives have not done a great job in the past, like I mentioned. I feel like there's a huge push from the LGBT community to really like make them see things their way. Like, you have to accept this, you know, and they're not really giving them a choice. And they're not even hearing out why they have resistance towards accepting like gender pronouns and, you know, the whole trans movement. I feel like there's a dialogue that's missing between the two groups. I feel as if they're very misunderstood, both sides. And I just don't think anybody's listening. I think if they did, they would realize that they, you know, maybe they're working towards the same thing, and there's not very much understanding between the two groups.
In the Republican Party, there's a group called the Log Cabin Republicans, and it's a bit of a misleading name. It's essentially a self-identified group of gay Republicans who take a chance. They're most commonly referred to during the primary, and they look at the various candidates for president, and then they sort of hitch their wagon to the one that's the most LGBT friendly. They've backed Trump the last, you know, few times to a lot of criticism. There's been a lot of critiques of the Log Cabin Republicans. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how it makes you feel when these critiques are levied. For example, there was a recent decision by the Justice Department to remove discrimination protections for gay couples to be able to adopt. So right. If you're in the area which is only served by a Christian agency, you can't adopt, you know, if you're, you know, self-identify as gay under this new directive under the Trump administration. You know, how do you reconcile these decisions from that administration with being gay and with being a Republican? Are these things that you think about?
No, of course. Yeah, I think about that, because when I hear, you know, when I hear that, immediately I sense rejection, like, oh, you know, we can't adopt. Why can't we adopt? Like, we can't be good parents. You know, I get defensive and I feel the anger that I feel a lot of the LGBT community feels. But I think it's more important that we look at the best interest of the kids. That's what it's about. That's what adoption's about. It's about, you know, putting kids that need a home with loving parents. And nobody's saying that gay parents can't be loving parents, but I think that, you know, these adoption agencies, especially if they're religious, if they believe, you know, because of their faith, that this is the perfect scenario for a family, then I think that it's important that they be allowed to keep that. Because if, you know, I feel like there's been a lot of studies and there's been a lot of, over the years, we've seen that still, like, it doesn't mean that kids can't thrive in an environment with two dads or two moms or whatever the, you know, a non-nuclear family. We've seen that. We know that they can. But we've also seen, I think, through the course of time, that kids always do better with a two-parent home, a mother and a father. Like, I think a lot of people maybe disagree with that, but I look at that and I think, well, yeah, they do probably pretty good. I'm sure there's some really crappy parents out there too, like, you know, straight couples that are, you know, have kids and they do a really bad job at it too, but that's not what we're looking at. We're looking at the bigger picture. And so I think it's a shame, like, of course, nobody wants to be discriminated against or told they can't adopt if they just want a child and they want to, you know, love a child. Like, that's not a bad thing. I just think that we have to look in the best interest of the kids. And if it's in the best interest that they be in this type of home, then they're going to do their best to put them in that type of home. And I don't really think there's anything wrong with that. Like, I it's not really about, you know, what I want. It's about what's best for the kids in that kind of situation, I think.
I think this is where the United States and Canada may differ, because there have been studies in the US and in Europe that have shown, and there's multiple studies, and we talked about them in the past on our show, that show that actually kids adopted by same-sex parents do on average better. It isn't necessarily evidence-based in terms of what is best for the kids, but rather it seems to fall on these adoption agencies' ability to choose for themselves what is in keeping with their religious understanding. And it seems to be that role of religion and that understanding of religion that is quite different in terms of how Canada and the United States is handling that.
I feel like they have the right to practice that faith, and they have the right to say, this is what we believe, this is what we, you know, this is what we stand for. And I don't think the government should be able to come in and say, no, you can't do that. Like, I know these are your beliefs. I know this is what you feel. This is what your organization believes in, but you can't. I feel like the government's coming in and taking away their rights to practice their faith, you know, and it's giving the government more control than I think the government needs. They already have too much control, I think. I don't think anyone's pushing anyone's religion when they're saying only straight people can adopt.
You know, you mentioned about, you know, the government maybe overstepping here. And I think that's really a sort of a central thread across the GOP and Republicanism. There's too much government. The government should not be interfering, and people should be left to their own devices. And obviously that differs from the Canadian perspective, where there's almost a sense of the government ought to be interfering. You know, people can't be trusted to their own devices. And, you know, there is definitely a difference there. And I think that might also be a difference in terms of Republicans and Democrats.
I feel like there is overstep from the government in a lot of these issues, like we see with conversion therapy, gay marriage, or the adoption issue. I feel as if the government is trying to go in and gain control in the church and say, telling them what they can do, what they can and cannot do. And it's like, if they practice a certain faith and they believe certain beliefs, I think they should be able to practice that freely. And I feel like this is just slowly, one by one, they're trying to take away their rights. And like, I feel like if a religion chooses to abide by certain rules and, you know, live a certain way, then I think the government shouldn't be overstepping, saying they can't do that, because then I just feel like it's the government's controlling the church then. And there should be a difference, you know?
I can't speak to how the United States government interacts with organized religion in the United States, but I do think that we do see that come out in decisions in terms of what the Justice Department does or does not support. We also saw that in Mike Pompeo in the positions he took internationally around rights and the importance of the freedom of religion. The last question I have for you relates to, what do you expect now that there is, it's gone from the House, Senate, and presidency being Republican to the House, Senate, and presidency being Democrat? What are you expecting over the next 4 years now that there's been this flip?
I honestly don't know. I feel it's a very weird place to be because, you know, I'm gay, yet I don't really feel like I'm a part of, I really can relate to a lot of the LGBT community because of my political beliefs. But at the same time, like, I don't really relate to my, the Republican Party because I don't really think that totally welcome there either, where there's just like, you know, it's just not really clicking. And so I feel like I don't really know where we're headed because I don't really think, I don't really know if the Democrats have our best interest in mind. Like, I don't really know what else they plan on doing that's going to affect me. Like, as far as the LGBT issues are concerned, I'm kind of I'm kind of scared just for the direction of this country. Like, I don't know what's happening. I don't think anybody does. And I feel like there's a lot of uncertainty. I don't feel very hopeful at this point.
We are just about out of time here. I want to thank you so much for joining us in the interview. We'll be back just after this.
I have pondered on those days gone by as I sat beside the mill and gazed upon the setting sun as it sank beneath the hill. I gaze on it once more, me boys, 'twas the very sight I see. It's just the same now as it was when we were sweet. Oh, how I long for those bright days to come again once more. But come again, they never will, for now I'm 64. The little fish swim in the brook and wandering down below. They swim on still and ever will as they did so long ago. It's just the same now as it was when we were sweet 16. Oh, how I long for those bright days to come again once more. But come again, they never will, for now I'm 64. Oh, the past is past and she's gone. On earth we'll meet. But we will meet in heaven above on that eternal shore. And when we meet, we'll part no more. We both will reign supreme. No more to sing of days gone by when we were sweet 16. Oh, how I long for those bright days to come again. But come again, they never will, for now I'm 64. Oh, how I long for those bright days to come again once more. But come again, they never will, for now I'm 64.
Hello and welcome back to CanQueer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Still Luke Smith. Seb will be joining us briefly at the end of the show. I am very excited for, this is definitely one of the interviews I was most looking forward to, for the team from Minority that we have joining us today. We are joined by the incredible team behind Minority. Do you want to introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Carell, aka Auntie Carell from Minority Report.
I'm Dewan, Auntie Dewan from Minority Report as well.
And I'm Jarrell, Auntie Jarrell. Or Auntie Henny from Minority Report.
Now, in the show, we've been talking a bit about how just life under Trump has been unthinkable decisions one after the other. You know, it's We mentioned the rollback of Title VII protections for kids by the Department of Education. I do believe at time of recording, which is a couple of days later, Biden's, you know, executive order rolled back the rollback, if that makes sense. It's definitely been quite a roller coaster. And we're just, you know, I feel like we're on the edge of the theme park, just watching it go up and down, up and down. As somebody who's been strapped in on the front seat, like, how was that? How has the experience been over the last 4 years?
Motion sickness.
That part.
There has been not a narrow wee on this roller coaster. No. Okay. We're screaming, I went off, stop the ride. We're
screaming for our lives. That is so true. As crazy as it looks on TV, is this as crazy as it is day to day here, honestly, or was, I should say.
I would even argue that I don't think any of us even be able to understand the level of PSTD, the trauma from the last 4 years. I know we've talked about when Biden got the nomination, a lot of us wept. And that was an indicator of how much emotional baggage and trauma that we have been holding for so long. And you think that you become numb to it, but we're human, you know, things affect us. And I don't even know that, and I think it'll take some time, as Carell had mentioned, and even Jarrell, this was really just a roller coaster of emotions and frustration and aggravation and helplessness and arguments and fights and grasping all at straws.
Yeah. A lot can happen in 4 years. And it's funny because I found myself like questioning like my whole entire like childhood and like all the years I've lived leading up to Trump being office. Like, was it really this bad? Like, did I just never know it was this bad? Yeah. It's like everything that was literally in the dark that was hiding and lurking in the corners in this country was like prime time, spotlight, 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 forefront. And it was just like, oh no, go away. Go back to wherever you came from. So it just revealed a lot of issues that I think a lot of people in our own country was very just naive to see. I mean, as a gay Black man, I obviously knew of a lot of the things that were happening, but there was, you know, still some few things that I was just like, okay, you know what? Now that we're able to collectively talk about this shared trauma, like this obviously has to end, you know, so.
It's hard for Canadians, I think, to wrap our mind around. You know, there's been a lot of talk of trauma, and I've seen it in TikTok comment sections and people being like, did we just live through this? And as Canadians, we're like, wow, that seemed crazy. But like, you know, earlier in the show, we were talking about the decision to allow religious adoption agencies to be able to discriminate against same-sex couples from adopting. And I think that's something that we sometimes lose. You know, that is someone's actual life in the States. You know, it's difficult for us to comprehend. I can't even begin to imagine being in the middle of it. I feel sorry for you. I'm glad that time is
now. Oh, you can feel sorry for us.
Yeah, you can feel sorry. Absolutely.
Feel sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard as someone. Yeah, as someone who like one day like adopt children, you know, like knowing that that was something that was being actually tried to be taken away from me, you know, it's just very disheartening. And at the end of the day, it's like, it should be about the kids. It should not be about the sexual orientation or preferences of the parents, as long as they are doing right by the child, which is what we all would want. If you are looking to adopt children, that should be the goal. Like, if that's happening, it should be okay, you know? It was just crazy just to see how much religion in the last 4 years played a lot into the homophobia and racism and the excuses behind why they were doing a lot of the horrible things they decided to do. Because God said so.
Right. And I mean, just look at even outside of the LGBTQIA+ community, like families coming to America seeking asylum and things like that. And then they're locking up kids and families at the border. So if they're going to do that to like straight people, you know, they're for sure going to do it to our community. So it's like Dewan said earlier, the trauma, I don't know. It might be decades, honestly, until some of this plays out of, but in a weird way, we needed it to play out because all of this was swept underneath the rug. And all he did was literally lift that rug up and exposed centuries of horror stories that this country has had. So in a way, he was the one that ripped the Band-Aid off and everyone had to deal with it all at once. And now it's time to do some tidying up, figure out what we need to do, get some extra Lysol and wipe everything down and just figure out why we haven't had a lot of these conversations. Why have we allowed so much to go on for so long and not have the conversations that we truly needed as a country, as a whole? Because this country's had a very interesting history and this is just another part of it.
We mentioned a bit about the sort of Trump legacy and we were talking about the two conservative justices on the Supreme Court, the large volume of justices at every other level of the judicial system. I mean, I think that's a significant legacy that needs to be, you know, thought about. But I'm almost wondering if a more concerning legacy is the fact that in the Trump era, they've normalized white supremacy. I wonder if what you think is the more glaring legacy to deal with, the judicial stacking or how what's considered normal may have been changed?
That's a good question.
I look at what's happened as now that we're hopefully turned a new leaf, I look at this as like catharsis. We had this leader who I think for a vast majority of the Republican Party, they wanted someone who could do no wrong because despite the ideals that govern the Republican Party, because it's not like the Republican Party in and of itself is evil or is a certain kind of way. But at the end of the day, politics, just like in any country, not just in the United States, politics is politics. And it's really politics is really about getting your way. It's about power. Although the premise of, you know, our politicians are supposed to be advocates for, you know, for everyone, history has shown us that in, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And if you have an opportunity to carve even more power without accountability, mm-hmm. right, then you can get your agenda across. So I think, you know, relative to your question, you know, what is most egregious, I think, at least from my point of view, I'd be curious to see what the aunties have to say because we always pick up on something different. But I think for me, it's this notion that for a very long time, the vast majority of Americans have kind of gone their willy-nilly way, kind of trusting that the government works the way that it's supposed to work. There are certain things within our control and there's certain other things that are beyond our control. And what a lot of minority individuals have experienced, you know, are kind of like anomalies. Like, yeah, there might be, you know, like this person being killed or this person, like the terrible things, but they're almost treated as outliers rather than the norm. Under the Trump administration, we've learned that the political system is set up to create an environment that is self-sustaining for the people that are in power. And it highlighted all the bad, the ugly, the tenaciousness that is apparent in every society, but has remained dormant because it hadn't been socially acceptable. Mm-hmm.
Just to that question, I think the judicial system is going to outlast a lot of us, unfortunately, mm-hmm. just the way it's set up. It's for life, you know? And so literally I'm going to have to live with a lot of those decisions the rest of my life. Probably the biggest fear for me, just because the white supremacists and the terrorism and things like that has always been here. A lot of minority groups have said it's been here. We've been telling everybody forever. And it took Trump for, again, that map to be like picked up and all these people running crazy, going wild. And luckily, there have been some allies, specifically like white folks within America that have been like, whoa, okay, we didn't realize it was this bad. We do need to do something. We do need to have these conversations. But then on the flip side, we saw that there were still 70 million people that voted for Trump. So it's a lot. But I think the judicial system part of it was probably going to be his biggest legacy, unfortunately.
I think what I would love to see accomplished first, fixing the racial divide. Because at the end of the day, a lot of those who are in power that are racist aren't going to care about us people of color until they are forced to start acknowledging, accepting us and appreciating us. And that's sadly the truth. And it starts with, you know, teaching all POC history within our culture and within our country and celebrating, you know, the diversity and the multitudes of cultures within our country and understanding that accepting each other is going to be the first step. Because you can't preach inclusive, you can't say majority without talking about everybody. And that's just the truth. And a lot of the people in the power are not speaking for everyone. They're speaking for themselves and those that look like themselves. It's a deep rooted issue that I think, again, will go on longer than I will probably exist. But I think no time is better than now. I bet, you know, don't wait till the end and start now.
All I know is on day one, Joe Biden had a stack of, prepared with a stack of initiatives that he pushed through. So if that's any indication of, right, he's just getting carpal tunnel syndrome, writing a page to sign it to make sure that, you know, all these things that have been, because, you know, to Jarrell's point, like, you know, in terms of like the work that needs to happen, I really don't care whether or not we quote unquote get rid of the racists. What I care about are, do we have policies in place that penalize racist behavior, right? Are we removing systemic racism from our institutions that disproportionately marginalize, you know, an already marginalized community? So I'm more concerned about like, what are the things we're going to put in place to prevent us from going from A, being able to roll this stuff back and providing equity and equality for everyone to have the opportunity and not allow different treatment for different people based off of things that they have no control over.
Well, I think that pivots quite nicely to the Equality Act that was tabled. It was passed, I think, a couple of years ago at this point, and it died a sad death at the Senate. In all your answers, one of the things that occurs to me is there's usually more than one flavor of conservative. And we mentioned it a little earlier, the idea that there's, you know, you get fiscal conservatism, mm-hmm. people who are worried about taxes, red tape, businesses. You get social conservatism as well. And that's where, you know, me and those folks tend to differ somewhat. But we were talking about the 77 million people who voted for Trump. You know, in my heart of hearts, I don't think all of those 77 people were like, yay, go Trump. I think they were like, I can't back Biden. I think that they're
party allegiance,
not hegemonic, that 77 million. I don't think they're all Trump's, you know, fangirls. You know, and there's a diversity there. And I wonder almost if there is a path forward for more moderate Republicans, more Republicans who aren't as extreme in the social conservatism, which is what's causing a lot of the issues. One of the things that makes me think about, or this reminds me of, is the work that was done in the state of Georgia and the fact that, you know, so many Black voices have been empowered and brought to the polls and taught, you know, this is how you literally go about getting the vote and the paperwork and the early ballots and so on. And it flipped the state. You know, that was considered to be a very winnable races for the Republicans, and they lost both.
Thanks, you know, to Stacey Abrams.
Stacey Abrams, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I live here in Atlanta, Georgia, and I saw it firsthand. Honestly, I forget who initially said it, but I know AOC has gotten a lot of the credit just saying, you know, maybe Georgia all this time wasn't a red state. It was just a suppressed state, which I agree. Just living here day to day, they done a number on this state to make sure that the minority vote does not come out, or is very difficult to come out. So they've done a very good job over the decades to suppress the Black vote down here in Georgia. But then it just took someone like a Stacey Abrams and she's not the only one. She's like the marketing head of it, you know, but she had a whole team. They underestimated how much we can rally together when we have maybe a figurehead like a Stacey Abrams helping us out. Georgia, hey, where I live, and I'm happy about it. I think another thing with Trump, what happened was specifically to him, before him, there were maybe variations in the Republican Party and conservative and maybe more moderate, whatever it may be. What happened is Trump is just so evil that it's hard for a lot of us that are maybe Republicans and things like that to know how you can still vote for him. And that's the hard part for a lot of us. It's just like, okay, before him, yes, you could be fiscally conservative and things like that, But specifically for him, if he's saying he's a Republican and the head of your party and he's doing all of this craziness, how can you still condone that no matter how much you love money, you know? And that's been, at least for me, the hardest part for even just like people I know and friends that I've had across life. I'm like, but how could you love money more than what's happening to someone that looks like me and that's me and my husband and things like that? So
I think that's a good point of like, you know, just like the power of hate. Mm-hmm. You know, like so much of what he preached came from a place of hate. And you ever like find yourself like at a crossroad when you want to say the wrong thing to someone, you just want to say something mean to someone, you be like, man, I'm actually going to say the nice thing.
Yeah.
Where he really played into that bad side and just allowed people to feel like, oh, it's okay to say that mean thing, or I shouldn't care about someone else's feelings. As soon as people were able to feel like, oh, well, I don't have to care about what I do or how I act or what I say to people, oh, this is freeing. Yes, let's follow this person, you know? But I think that's quite a bit of those 77 million people probably voted for him was just because they were following that freeing part of being a hateful person, you know, of not caring about anything.
America's built on the idea of capitalism. And it
sure is.
And I think for a lot of white Americans, particularly those that saw value in Trump and still see value in Trump. And I'm not talking about the ideology extremists. I'm talking about your middle of the road, Joe and Ma individual, Jones or whatever, Smith.
Yeah, right, Smith.
But I know them. Yeah.
I had to unmelanate the last name on that. but I think what a lot of people saw in him was what they saw in the reality TV shows and what we teach ourselves, you know, like not all, but a vast majority of the inputs that we receive, that we take in as Americans, when we look at television, music, entertainment, family life, etc. It's about, you have to be the best. You have to look out for number one and damn everybody else. You know, he had a TV show that was made popular by firing people, you know, so clearly there is of groupthink that took over a vast majority of, you know, particularly the Republican Party, that says, I now belong to kind of like an elite group. They won't recognize it as white supremacy, because I believe that the underpinning of that, right, the underpinning of that is white fragility, right? Mm-hmm. I'm seeing all of these black, brown and other faces and whatever you call that. You know, I'm seeing all of these non-white individuals that are, in my view, taking over the America that I know and love. And when you have somebody that is drilling in rhetoric that talks about, you know, let's go back to when time was simpler. Let's go back to a time when there was, painting this kind of picture, it's understandable, not acceptable, but it's understandable that you would have people that buy into that, because A, they want to belong to a movement. We as humans want to belong to something bigger than ourselves. And they were able to belong to something that fed this queasiness that I think a lot of, you know, white Americans felt around the changing face of America and the fact that we are striving to be more egalitarian. We're striving to be more, you know, more considerate of other people. And these are counter to all the messages that white individuals have heard their entire lives about how amazing they are and how wonderful you are. It's everybody else that, you know, that is terrible and has problems and et cetera.
I think this is a conversation that we definitely should visit again, if you folks are up to it. Maybe we'll
zoom in more
specifically. Yes. Like I said very quickly there, we are about to run out of the time of the show. I want to jump back to Sebastian for the end of the show. You will be able to catch all of the interviews. I want to thank you so much, Karel, Jarrell, Dewan, all of the aunties for joining me today. It is so greatly appreciated. Where can our listeners go and hear you speak more broadly?
Yeah, you can find us on all social media. We're out there. Probably Instagram's the one we're probably on the most. So that's Minority Report, like you're sipping tea. So MINORITEA Report. But also on Twitter, TikTok, Clubhouse now is a new one. So we're on that as well. So yeah, just find us out there, and we love talking with everyone. So DM us if you want to. And
thank you so much again. It is greatly appreciated. So, Sebastian, that was our interview with Minority. And of course, before then, we had Christopher Daniels. And then before then, we had Nate Garner. What do you think about America going from one to the other? How do you think that's going to impact things?
Well, I think definitely in terms of LGBT rights, I mean, this is a no-brainer. The Democrats, especially under the leadership of Joe Biden, are very much into sort of reconciling a lot of the issues. My only concern is a lot of it is being done through executive orders, and it doesn't have the staying power that it would have if it went through Congress. But on day one, he undid a whole bunch of weird decisions, and that's very positive. So definitely 100% in terms of LGBT rights, I'm incredibly optimistic about the future of the United States under Biden.
Excellent. Well, me too. Now we're playing out with Good Place to Hide at the Time by Partner, now that I was able to actually read my illegible handwriting. Next week is our 200th episode. I nearly said anniversary. It's our 200th episode. Be sure to join me and Sebastian for more Can Queer. I've been Nick Smith.
And I'm Sebastian. And thank you for listening. I am walking. Let's do-